Blog Talk Radio.
The motherfucking saga continues.
Yo, yo, what's up, world? It's Badass Thuggin' like I usually do. And you better turn it up, bust some speakers out, cause we off the motherfucking cuff. You dig how we do it? Dog Pound Gangsters 2000 and beyond. Blech.
What's up with it, y'all? Man, don't change that down. This your player partner, the legendary Cocaine. And you tuned in live to Off the Cuff Radio. Better not touch that down. Wait.
Yeah, this is Cassidy, the hustler. And right now, you listening to the Guillotine. Show them the respect they deserve, man. Off the Cut Radio, man. Y'all already know how they doing it, man. I need y'all to stay tuned. They've been doing it for years. So show them the respect they deserve. And you heard it out of bars, mom. Easy.
Keep it moving like this. Yo, this your boy Rampage. You're not rocking with the best. With Off the Cut Radio. Classic. History. Fix your face to all you haters. We off the cuff, baby.
What's up, everybody? This your girl, Bonnie Dollars, the queen of trap, representing Crenshaw, and you are now tuned in with Off the Cuff Radio. What's up?
What's up, y'all? This is Miss Irresistible, giving a shout-out to the live show on Friday nights, Off the Cuff Radio, and I'm live from the 704. Make sure y'all tune in for the blazing hot music.
What it ain't, what it do. Chilly Chill from that original Lynch Mob. Off the Cuff Radio, always where it's at on Friday night. West, y'all.
We are now here at episode 571 of Off the Cuff Radio. I'm your host, King Eric, the Media Assassin. And this show is sponsored by Buddy Boy Entertainment, Fleetwood and the Cot Pickers, Screwball Radio, Da Vinci Clothing. And I got my host, T-Max with the Facts on the line. What's good, man?
Man, another fantastic Friday on that OTC frequency. I'm your co-host, T-Max on Off the Cuff Radio. Shout out to our co-host, Pierre Hellas and LH and Chillin. Of course, shout out to DJ Sincere Dirty Basement Radio. And tonight is a very special show, ladies and gentlemen. We took some time, and we finally made it happen. The guest we have tonight, words cannot express her wizardry, being a lady of skill on the six strings of so many levels of genius, gorgeousness, legal prowess. This girl is a philanthropist. She is a musician. She is all things awesome. She is the epitome of why black girls rock indeed. And after a lot of time, we finally have her. We are so honored. We are so privileged in terms of having her expertise and her excellence on Off the Cuff Radio. Without further ado, she is the front woman for the band of Texas Lips. Ladies and gentlemen, the greatest guitar, Gabby. Hey, lady.
Hey. I got to correct you before we jump into it, but it's a common mispronunciation. It's actually Guitar Gabby and the Tulips Band.
Yes, ma'am. Guitar Gabby and Tulips Band. Yes, ma'am. Yes. Man, we are so happy to have you on. It's so great to finally get you. You know, how you doing?
Wow. Good. How about y'all?
We are great. Yeah, I mean, the accolades, Gabby, you have, you know, musician, legal scholar, philanthropist. I mean, the list goes on in terms of your achievements and everything that you do. And we got to get into all of it. So tell everybody a little bit about yourself, where you're from, and everything.
So my name is Guitar Gabby. I'm the founder of an international black female and gender expansive rock collective called the Tulips Band. I'm from Atlanta, born and raised. What else? I'm a musician. I'm a lawyer. I'm a Spelman graduate, HBCU in the house. And I love music. I love philanthropy. I think music is one of the only things that transcends everything and everyone in this galaxy. So I'm a proud musician, and I believe that the gift of music is special. So I don't take it lightly.
I mean, being an ambassador of that, you know, is something in terms of learning. Enjoying music is one thing. To play it is a talent that is hard fought and hard won in terms of being able to do it well. You've achieved both in abundance. And, I mean, in the spirit of Sister Rosetta Tharpe and those that came before you, you know, definitely you have really laid a foundation and blazed a trail for young Black girls across the world to know that their expression is their voice and can't nobody tell them how to do it. Getting into it, I mean, tell us about from when you started in terms of when you began to pick up the guitar, who were your inspirations, and how ultimately, you know, Guitar Gabby and the Texas Lip, you know, band became to be.
Tulips band.
It's all good.
It's all good because the X is in there, and I'll tie that in now. But I started playing the piano really early. I didn't stick with it for too long, but looking back, I am happy that my mom put me in piano lessons because it's just been the foundation for all of the instruments I would pick up down the line, and just really my appreciation for the structure of music. And then I started playing the guitar around the age 13 or 14, but before then, or right before then, I started playing the clarinet and the oboe in middle school, and I was really, really into it. And that kind of opened up my eyes to scoring, and I would listen to and try to learn a lot of Lord of the Rings soundtrack and Star Wars and all of my favorite sci-fi things that I would watch growing up with my dad. And then I would pick up guitar, and then I just taught myself how to play by listening to a lot of artists that I loved. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but I realized I was really into guitar-driven songs, rock and roll. So I listened to a lot of Nirvana, a lot of punk bands. And by the time I got to college, I learned that we made rock and roll. That was birthed out of Black culture. And then I learned of Sister Rosetta Tharpe. And so right after that period in college of just learning more about my history and my culture and the music and everything else that comes with the beautiful, diverse Black people community, I started the Tulips Band. And so I was playing for Diamond from Crime Mob here in Atlanta, and they wanted an all-girl band. So I pulled together the Tulips. We weren't called the Tulips at the time. I forgot what Diamond's label called the band, but simultaneously, I started the Tulips, and we've been rocking and rolling since then. And that was like 2014. I think it was 2013 or 14. And so, So down the line, changed the spelling over some years, but we put the X in there, Tulips, to just kind of represent that Black people don't have boundaries. You know, we created this, and look how rock has evolved. So that's kind of what that stands for.
Man,
plus, on top of that, what you guys doing too with Atlanta, because you know that came up around the time Atlanta was really hitting another renaissance, and now you open up another lane for rock artists to really get their vision and their voices heard.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, when you think about it, Gabby, in terms of a lot of the rock and roll artists, I mean Chuck Berry, you know, like we mentioned before, Sister Rosetta Tharpe. I mean, even going into the modern day with Dr. No, you know, the group Bad Brain. Suicidal Tendencies.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, of course, we can't forget Jimi Hendrix. I mean, Rocky George, Suicidal Tendencies, that were a blend of Black, White, and Latin. Of course, Living Color, Eric Gale.
Tina Turner.
Yeah, and of course, Mother's Finest. You know, we can't forget them. I mean, so, and it's crazy because a lot of times we find as Black people, the stuff that we don't always understand, we tend to ridicule or dismiss. Myself, I'm all there, my brother knows this, you know, our guest we talked to, I'm a huge hard rock, heavy metal, thrash metal aficionado. Morbid Angel, Slayer, you know, Pantera, Suicide, Megadeth, all that. You know, so
me too.
It,
because it brings a different energy. It brings a different energy. It brings a different vibe, especially. It's in my personal gym list. Like, you know, you make you feel like you're Conan the Barbarian when you're hitting them weights, when you hear certain songs. You know what I mean? So, rock has a different vein.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
What was the process like in terms of finding the musicians, you know, for the band, in terms of when you really got serious about it?
Well, starting off, the drummer, hold on, I'm trying to go back in my memory. The drummer, keys player, the drummer in particular, Mo, I had known Mo for a really long time before I even started playing for Diamond. So Mo was the first person I called. And then over time, the keys player and the bass player, I kind of just knew also from just being around the industry. But after that, a lot of it was social media. A lot of it was social media to the point now where we have 35 black female and gender expansive musicians around the world. And honestly, all of these amazing musicians, I met most of them through social media.
Wow.
So so I would say it's a mixture of just like the Tulip brand evolving over the years and kind of the message that we stand for that attracts the right people. Also just I am like the queen of researching things on the internet. Like if I need something, I'm going to find it.
I mean, and that's how you do it. And what, you know, when we look at social media, a lot of people look at social media and the fuckery that goes on in it, but people forget social media can actually be used for something positive. You know,
right.
Absolutely.
You know, you and me, we had been, you know, we'd all been in, you know, talks for, you know, some time when I first, you know, started following you on IG, and I was just amazed in terms of your tenacity, talent, you know, what you and the band had. And I was telling King, you know, we got to get her on the show, you know, because she brings a voice or a level of diversity that is not always, you know, talked about, but needs to be shown in its appreciation. Once you really got going in it, I mean, what was it like during that time in Atlanta, and, you know, you kind of being a part of it?
You know, because I'm from Atlanta and I had cousins and my grandfather were also in the music industry on different levels, most of it centered around songwriting and different styles of music. My grandfather was more of the, like, Earth, Wind, and Fire type of songwriter. And some of my cousins were more of the Nuck If You Buck, you know, like that era of hip hop. So for me, being from Atlanta, being in high school where I heard all types of music, and then just being black in Atlanta at that period, you know, I was exposed to a lot of different styles of music. But one of the styles that I never saw with black people involved, at least, was rock music. And that's kind of what pushed me to say, you know what, I don't know how, but down the line, I want my music to have a message. I want it to be guitar-driven, but more importantly, I want to be able to use my voice and my songwriting ability to show the diversity of music that is birthed out of our culture. Because I feel like the music industry has done a great job of appropriating our music and our culture and our style and then repackaging it into this, you know, corporate, you know, marketed, branded package that makes it feel like it's that everything is separated or independent of each other. Like pop is not the same as rock. They have no business doing anything in the same area. But I feel like the intersections of all of those genres and industries, to me, that's where the real magic happens. So I love artists like Smino that take different styles of music in every era and blend it into something that makes sense. But so that all of that to say that I was exposed to a lot of different types of music, and it challenged me to be able to figure out how to pull, make that into something that was me.
And that's something that is important because there's no greater gratification than knowing you have a vision and being able to see it through. Now, in terms of this, because obviously as you being an accomplished musician, being a legal scholar as well. So, because you mentioned lawyer, you know, I mean, so this is, you're just a whole type of amalgam of just academia and all aspects. So where did the legal interest come from?
You know, that came early on, too, just in terms of my exposure to it. I didn't realize that that's what it was, but like I said, my grandfather was in the music industry. He also was one of the first black police officers in the city of Atlanta. My father would later follow in those footsteps and being a police officer as well. And so I kind of, I was exposed to this business savvy. My grandfather owned a lot of businesses growing up, and as a kid, I would be out there, you know, just helping out grandfather and my dad and my mom run these family businesses, but I didn't really know what it was that I was doing. But having the exposure would help me down the line, you know, realize, see something that I do every day now and be like, oh, you know what, I know how to do that, because I remember being exposed to that from a young age. So by the time I got to writing music and my parents saw how much I loved writing music and guitar and instruments, my parents were like, you gotta learn the business side of this. You know, we're not in the industry like you want to be, but we do know that it is a business and we know how to run business. So you need to learn the business side of stuff. So I started reading the copyright website from a young age. I learned how to copyright my music, copyright all my stuff. And then I would learn, you know, how to turn that into the foundation of Tulip. And then eventually graduating from my undergraduate degree in environmental science, my mom was like, you should go to law school. And I was like, oh, I don't think so. but my mom found a really cool program and recommended it to me at Vermont Law. And I said, you know what, I'll give it a try. And when I did, my eyes were open to so much because I realized that the foundation of law is something that I naturally like to do, think and strategize. And then I realized that plus, you know, learning the copyright and intellectual property side and then being a musician, I realized that I have all three things that are necessary to build something sustainably. So that's kind of how that started, just being exposed by my parents at a young age.
I mean, but that's something that that is very important, what you were saying, Gabby, because it has to do a lot. We've talked on this show so much with our guests about how important it is to know all the legal aspects of the business in terms of copyrights, in terms of understanding your royalties, just knowing all of this, because we see so many artists from all genres. You know, we looked at the situation, you know, with Elvis back in the day, you know, for all the accomplishments Elvis had, you know, Elvis never traveled overseas. You know, Bob Parker, you know, the colonel, he was a dude that was basically, Elvis didn't even really know what was going on with all of his business. We look at what Prince was fighting for years back when he was with Warner Brothers, you know, with the slave thing, because he was not a, his thing was they owned his name, and Prince was had to fight for all those years. But he was a self-enterprise, so he was able to sustain himself financially fighting it, where a lot of these artists, they don't have that money for a long legal fight. I mean, there are just countless stories we see of what was going on with, you know. But it's just countless stories. When you got into the business of it, what did you find in terms of being a black woman, being a black rock musician, and the challenges and hurdles that you all had to grow, you know, had to go through?
Just actually, this question ties into what I was going to mention when you were just talking about Prince, which is, you know, when I got an opportunity to go to Minneapolis a few months ago to work with a client, and when I went up there, it was my first time really being in the city where Prince was from to fully understand the impact and the legacy that Prince had, not just on the city and music, but people. And so I actually developed a course about music business, and it's called Vantage Point, Prince versus the Slave Industry. And in that, we talk about the beginning of how Prince started off, getting to Warner Brothers, you know, eventually becoming an independent artist. And we align that with a lot of the inspiration that I had to understand business and use that as a foundation. So I say all that to say that, you know, it's not like, and I think this is one thing that people misunderstand in general in the world, because we have social media, we have the internet, everything is at our fingertips 24/7. Right. You can get what you want, when you want it, when you want it. But that's not how sustainable business works. And so, you know, starting from nothing and really, really, really building every step to get one level higher than you were last year is difficult. But I also think that that's kind of, for me, what tested my business savvy and tested my passion and tested my principles of how I approach life. Is this something that I really wanted? or do I just want to say that I want it? And what I mean by that is, growing up, my parents made me work from a young age. I was exposed to business. I was exposed to environmental science. All of my jobs were at zoos. I interned at environmental organizations. So I had to learn how to be a Black woman in the corporate space and in the music space at the same time. And so I needed that to be able to get me to where I am now, because being a Black woman in this space, it is difficult, and not just in the entertainment industry, but when I go into conservation and law, when I'm in boardrooms, you know, I'm usually the youngest person in the room, and I'm also usually the only Black person or Black woman or person of color in the room. So being exposed to that from a young age through environmental science and through things that have nothing, seemingly nothing to do with music, honestly, is what tested me and gave me the tools to build a career, not just in entertainment, but in entertainment, conservation, and law. Now I have three different modes, three different streams of income. So I'm sorry, that was a really long-winded answer, but I'm really passionate about
No, please,
business.
Please,
it's
all keep going. Keep going. No, keep going.
It's all good.
No, this is, Boo,
it's
this
so
is your time.
All this I know.
No, Boo, this is your time. Go with it. This is your time. Go.
People just don't know it. I think that's the one good thing that we can take from social media and the way the technology has evolved over the years. It doesn't have to be anything negative. And this, to me, is kind of, it goes back to the principle of perspective. Your cup can be half empty or it can be half full. You can see it as opportunity or you could see it as a setback. It doesn't really matter how you look at it. Somebody somewhere is going to look at it opposite of how you do. So what are you going to make of it? So I just say all that to say that, you know, using social media and learning the boring, quote unquote, boring things in order to build a entertainment career, you know, those were the stepping stones and those were necessary. And I want artists to be more aware that there are possibilities. You don't have to sign to a record label. You don't have to accept what someone gives you. Everything is negotiable in life. Everything. So,
like they said,
yeah.
Yeah, like they were saying, you know, business is not what you, right. Go ahead, Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that you don't want to go in there, first of all, timid. Because, you know, if you come in there timid, they're going to pretty much snowball you on any type of deal possible. They'll throw you the lowest denominator, and they thinking that you're timid, play on that. And sometimes it depends on, because this thing is like a game of chess, too, because, you know, when you're dealing with these labels, it's like, sometimes you got to play dumb to get them.
Yep. You got to know how to play the game.
Like they say, business is not what you get in terms of what you deserve. It's what you can negotiate and how you can leverage. I mean, that's so important. It's like, and what you said, Gabby, about, you know, you got to learn the boring part. It's like Mr. Miyagi teaching Daniel's son, you know, with a wax on, wax off. You know, he had to understand the technique before he actually got to the real mastery of the movement. You know, so this is not something that everybody starts at the top. Everything you were saying is true in terms of, you know, just moving on social media, you know, and just being independent. Like, you know, King, you know, what he started with Off the Cuff Radio, you know, this is something that he just had a passion, you know, to do it. You know, he went into this with no cosign, no nothing, but, you know, found some people along the way who believed in the vision that he did. And, you know, we're just moving and we're able to talk to awesome people like yourself on our journey, you know. So this is a blessing for us. Now, you speak about your conservationist, and especially with the name Tulip. And I'm thinking this is why you have the green in your guitar to symbolize that. Am I right or am I wrong?
No, the green is a twofold thing. One, it's always been my favorite color. I love green.
Okay.
But I think that was a subconscious thing. So by the time I got to building Tulip, and I was like, you know what? I need something. Like, how do I build my brand? Why don't I just use something I already like? Green. Green guitars. Green logo. Green this. Green. Green stands for money. It stands for nature. It stands for guitar. Gabby. It stands for my guitar. Like, green is everywhere.
And how was it in terms of getting So in terms of like the early sessions, songwriting, you know, writing original material, you know, what was that like in terms of really putting it all together to really find the sound that fit, you know, yourself and the band's aesthetics for what you were driving for?
You know, when I first started writing music, I think I started writing in a vacuum because I taught myself how to play an instrument that would become an integral part of my career by listening to rock music. But because I didn't know the history of rock and roll, I always thought of it as, you know, there's rock and then there's all this other stuff. But when I started learning not just the history in terms of the creators of rock and roll, and then going to an HBCU, I started realizing that, you know, our history, our people are dynamic and diverse people by nature, by genetics. So maybe that means that rock doesn't have to, maybe a rock song for Guitar Gabby doesn't have to sound like a traditional rock song. What if it sounds like a love ballad? What if it sounds like, I don't know, like a rock guitar beat, I mean, a rock guitar music, and then having, you know, somebody rapping over it, but then switching back to like this grunge type of vibe. So for me, my writing style has evolved over the years, but I also have to say that, you know, my dad really pushed me to think outside of the box, not just business-wise. And then my mom, coming from education, you know, teaching me to push outside of the box in terms of how can education be something that you integrate as part of what you do and your mission. Music doesn't have to be separate from education. You teach environmental education, teach music education, teach law education. Education also transcends. So for me, just kind of pulling all of those things together and then using real-life experiences, I've always loved philosophy. I read a lot of philosophy, and kind of letting that influence my lyrical content. All of that together just kind of created, you know, what my writing style is now, just evolving over time. So, and then the beautiful thing about the Tulips is that when I bring original music to the Tulips fan, I'll say, all right, this is the song. You know, this is what it looks like. This is the song structure, sheet music. Some musicians like sheet music. Some musicians need to just hear it. Some musicians want to see the song profile. Some people want to see me play it to kind of wrap their mind around the core of the music. And then from there, when we get on stage, I tell everybody, play the song how you play it. If you're naturally a gospel drummer, then play like a gospel drummer. I'm not asking you to conform. And as a matter of fact, the style of music that we're playing was based on gospel. So let's, like, really dig into that more. So the Tulips Band is a really diverse group of people, not just as people and who they are, but the way that they all play. Everybody comes from different styles. Everyone comes from different backgrounds, different regions and different industries. But again, I think that's the beautiful thing about Tulips, and that's become, you know, the core of who we are. It's not just rock. It's not just hip-hop. It's not just pop. It's not just any of this one thing. It's an amalgamation of all of these things and people and perspectives and voices put together. But you just got to listen for it. You got to pay attention. And a lot of times people don't pay attention to the things around us. But that's, you know, that's life. You know, it's the world. It's, again, we have social media and everything at our fingertips. So if it takes people longer than 5 seconds to think about it and they don't get it, then they just move on. So
yeah,
my music is definitely for people that listen and can connect.
One of your songs, Parallel, Another Tier of Prison of Life, what was the inspiration behind that? Because that Another Tier, Prison of Life.
So Another Tier, so I have both of those. Another Tier, I'm answering your question twofold, because Another Tier is one song, and then Prison of Life is another song, but it's also the name of one of my albums. So, but
right,
in terms
right.
of like the foundation of both of those, I wanted I think around that time that I wrote Another Tier, I had started getting into, like, deep in my grunge bag. So I was listening to a lot of Alice in Chains. And I really loved the way that Layne Staley added a deep vocal texture. And so when I was writing that era of my music, I was like, you know what? What does that sound like for me? So I wrote Another Tier.
Right.
But then with Prison of Life, I wanted it to be something that had a message that was loud and clear, but again, only if you listen or if you pay attention. And I wrote that song during, I'm not sure which person of color was murdered by the hands of the police at this time, because it's been so many. Some years ago, maybe like 3 years ago, I wrote Prison of Life from that.
When you talk about the grunge movement, because it has such a opinionated view of it for a lot of heavy metal heads myself, like Nirvana, Alice in Chains, two bands I absolutely love, with two front men, Lane Staley and Kurt Cobain, who we lost way too early. When you think about Lane Staley, like you said, in terms of what he bought, why do you think, and I wanted to ask you a twofold question on this, in terms of what do you feel that Lane and Kurt both had on the genre in terms of influence, musicianship, and especially when you look at Alice in Chains, even with his passing of William Duvall coming in and Jerry Cantrell. I mean, of course, they're still going strong. I mean, but why do you think those two bands resonate so much in the grunge community to this day? And even the rock community at large.
Yeah, I agree. Definitely at large. Because, you know, anytime we play our rendition of Teen Spirit, it doesn't matter who you are, where you came from, what color you are, how you identify, what side of the venue you on, everybody's coming into the room. Everybody knows that song. But I honestly think that, and this is just my interpretation, because honestly, Kurt Cobain is one of my top five songwriters, but also like an artist as a whole. But for me, I've always been drawn to the way that Kurt Cobain took everyday life things that he was experiencing when he was experiencing them and turned it into a song that anybody anywhere from any walk of life could turn on and fuck with. Sorry. Oh, can I pause?
Yeah. Okay.
Be explicit if you want. I'm screaming. So for Kurt Cobain, that's always been one of my biggest inspirations. But then honestly, again, growing up and learning about the history of rock and roll, the history of grunge, I learned of Tina Bell and how much of her sound and the way that she performed.
Yeah,
Yes, to me, she's the queen of grunge.
Seattle, yes.
Yes. Well, that whole Seattle movement, like everything. So to me, again, it goes back to the way that people take experiences and being a black person and thinking about the history in this country for black people. We have always used music as a way to tell stories, as a way to encourage, as a way to empower and educate the next generation. So for me, learning about Tina Bell and then seeing the evolution of Kurt Cobain and Alice in Chains and Pearl Jam and this whole movement of grunge, it looked like a colorful roller coaster to me when I listened to it, you know. So, and then with Lane Staley, I think again, for me, it was the texture. I think the texture of his voice, but not just the texture of his voice, it was the lyrical content. I can listen to Alice in Chains all day, every day, and still probably miss the message in some of these songs. But then I go back and listen to it for the 58th time, and I'm like, you know what? Simplicity. Less is more. And I feel like grunge is one of those genres that kind of gives that. You don't have to be doing anything extra crazy up and down the guitar neck to create a grunge song. Grunge is a movement. It's a vibe. It's a feeling. So, yeah, that's my two cents.
I think what grunge is to the rock community is what conscious music is to the hip-hop community, because that music has, like, a heart-to-heart message. So they came into the game where everybody was on that. They were mosh pitting. They was on cocaine and booze. You know what I'm saying? Wearing makeup and long hair. But then when Nirvana came in, they came in with you know, painting a different picture of life. And that changed Vanguard. And that's what made them stand out in the 90s.
Yeah. 100%.
We're just all of a sudden on the Alice in Chains tangent in Nirvana. But I mean, one song by Alice in Chains I absolutely fucking love was Wood, off the single soundtrack in 1992. And like you said, Gabby, it was not a complex song, but even though the musicianship was kick ass, but when, you know, the way Lane used his voice as an instrument, he's like, into the flood again. Off the Dirt album with the opening track, The Them Bones, I mean, it's just I mean, it's like dun 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 dun. I mean, just the aggressiveness, and then you look at the songs, reflective songs like "Down in a Hole."
Yeah.
I mean, and this is always one of the most bittersweet moments in rock history. For those that know, they know the 1992-93 MTV Unplugged he did when he sang "Nutshell."
Yeah.
Ooh, I mean, that was like, you know, because he was struggling with his, you know, Lane was struggling with his heroin addiction, and that song, not to be melancholy or macabre, that was like he was singing at his own funeral.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, when I think of Lane Staley and just like the impact, one of the other things that has always attracted me to Alison Chains' sound, specifically, I'm speaking specifically regarding Lane Staley's voice, is that a lot of the breath that it takes to sing like Wood, for example, it kind of feels like Beyonce be taking the same amount of breath. Like, it'd be, you got to take a full deep breath to sing that, like, whole, because he sings in like one breath. Like the song, like, you got to really, really get in that core and that gut, like Beyonce.
Yeah.
So I love it.
I mean, so when you look at how those influences came in you, you know, what were some of the other projects to where you had various influences from different genres in terms of what you were doing with
it? When I first started playing instruments, I started with the oboe and the clarinet, and I would listen to a lot of soundtracks, sci-fi soundtracks, to just learn the structure of music. But shortly after that, I started studying classical guitar for about 3 years, and I started really, really getting into the structure of music in a different way, and I started learning how to read sheet music. So one of my favorite composers is Wagner. And for me, I think I've always been drawn to classical music for a lot of different reasons, but one of the biggest reasons, and I feel like Wagner really does a good job of this in the history of his music, is just making... There's so many instruments and pieces and moments happening in classical music at the same damn time. And in order to, I'm putting myself in that time period where it's not like you had, you know, logic, you know, or all of these different sounds and you know, a computer. Wagner and many other classical artists at that time were creating all of these different sounds and textures of instruments in their heads and then putting that on sheet music and then conducting and leading a choir or a symphony or an orchestra through that. So I've always pulled from classical music as well, just in terms of the structure and the foundation of stuff, but I really like the simplicity that grunge gives. So I kind of have merged the foundations of both of those into the foundation of my music. And then also I've always been really inspired by Beyonce, as I just mentioned. But
not just for her
tenacity, but and her performance and her vocal ability. But I love that Beyonce is not afraid to try different styles of music. So when Lemonade came out and I heard Don't Hurt Yourself, that was the first time I felt like we heard a strong black woman's voice inside, like packaged in this rock song. Not to say that no one ever did it, because again, we have Tina Turner and all these amazing artists. But
Janet Jackson,
when I heard
Black Cat.
Yeah, but when I heard Beyonce do that, the time that came out, but the message was coming from, as a woman, a place of hurt, but like packaging it in something that we hadn't heard from Beyonce before, I like that. So Beyonce is a huge inspiration. And then also, speaking of Tina Turner's early, early work, like Break Every Rule is one of my favorite albums. She has 3 or 4 songs in there that I really, really, really like, just because like the classic 80s, you know, distorted guitar with the power of her vocals, but also, again, a message that kind of speaks to pushing me, you know, as a black woman carrying the torch down the road. Anywho, I get so excited about music. So, but yeah,
it's
those
okay.
are some of my inspirations.
Let's stay excited because we got plenty of time. it's so rich because we look at all these, you know, we think about, you know, Beyonce. We think about Tina, you know, Tina, and God bless her soul. To see Tina do what she did is what they call in Hollywood, which is so hard to do. She pulled it off with the second act. You
yeah.
know,
yeah.
and, you know, how she was able to, and, you know, we all know the story, you know, between, you know, between love, what's got to do with it, and, you know, Rita, you know, and, you know, knowing, you know, reading, you know, her biography, you know, so we all know what she went through with Ike and how she literally had nothing and came back and showed she still had a hell of a lot more than what people knew. You know, but so many times, especially with black women, we've seen a lot of black women have been marginalized. They've not been allowed to be themselves, from hair to expression. And it's always been something that and black people in general, we've always had to toe a line in terms of what society tried to impose on us about what their aesthetics and propriety were. And the thing is, we are a culture. We are a people with a history of survival, innovation, creation. You know, we can't be put in a box. You know, we've done too much. Our history has shown that. So when you and the Tulips really start getting out there and y'all really start playing, and when was that watershed moment when you were like, okay, we got something and the people are really feeling it? Tell us about the first show that you all did.
That's a good question. I think the first show that we did, it was two different communities. The Bonfire community here in Atlanta. A shout out to my homie Terry that runs Bonfire. But Bonfire, and then what was the name? Apache. Apache, I think, was our first gig, and then the next night I think we ended up like doing Bonfire or something like that. But that community, if you're from Atlanta and you've been to Apache or you know the Apache vibe, then you know that that type of community is the black people that are super welcoming, that they're open to trying and listening to new things. Apache always had a stage and a space for anybody to try something different, from Al Smith and the jam sessions. I used to go there and just hang out and vibe and listen. And then when I started kind of picking up singing with Tulips, then we used to go up there and play at Apache and jam out with Al. And then we started playing for other artists in the city to kind of experiment with how can this rock-facing sound pick up other people's music and interpret it in a way that artist might not even have ever heard their music like that before, but also being able to reach the community for the venues that we were at. So, I mean, at first, though, I think a lot of the people that became fans, if you will, I don't like calling people fans, but supporters of Tulip were the underground rappers, the underground black alternative community. Like the people, it's now called punk black, but back in the day, you know, Vaughn and I used to be out here in the street doing our thing, building bands and creating these spaces with a lot of other amazing artists, like Hero the Band, those are our brothers. But yeah, I guess I'm saying that it was, and I think still very much is, Atlanta has this underground alt community, but I feel like because of social media and entities like Tulips and Punk Black and the old Afro Punk and other, and Hero the Band and Willow Smith and all of these other artists, we kind of now have this, people are more open to checking out black people doing rock and punk, even if you don't know the history of it. You're still kind of intrigued because, again, I think going back to what you said, we can't be put in a box. So you see people like, and this a guy I just saw on social media, his name is Breezy, and he's a black alternative artist, like alternative hip hop. And somebody sent him a message, I think earlier today, and said that, you know, no offense, but I like your sound, but it's not going to go over well with black people because they've never heard it before, and white people don't like it because you're black. So, you know, you're kind of just stuck. And the response that I saw in the comment section was so many black people of all demographics, of all sub-communities within the black community were like, no, we're open to hearing things. It's just we didn't know this was our history because y'all appropriated it. It's not that we're closed-minded. It's just when you don't know better, you don't do better. So I saw that to say that I think, you know, for us, it was a rough start just because I wasn't sure how people were going to be receptive, because prior to that point, I only saw white people in that space, white men. But I also, going back to the fearlessness that I admire Beyonce and Tina Turner, I decided, let me take a step let me think back to what, you know, my ancestors would do, Harriet Tubman and Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Tina Bell. And yeah, how did they take that first step? So we took the first step and here we are.
And you know what's crazy is that comes with being a trailblazer, being the head of the class, because if you look at even hip hop now, everybody's incorporating the rock star look. Like the Lil Uzi Verts, and I think Lil Uzi Verts, Playboi Carti, to a degree, Kanye West. Everybody is now incorporating the rock star look, so to speak. Lil Wayne, the list goes on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think the one thing about it, though, that kind of galls me a little bit, though, for real, is that rock, no matter who does it, it should be respected. And my thing is, you shouldn't necessarily wear the shirt. Or, this is just my personal thing, because I feel like it's more than just a fashion statement. It's a lifestyle. It's an attitude of which is befitting, you know, the knowledge and the history of it. You know, and a lot of times, I guess more than anything, I don't want to see it become trendy just because it's a style. You know, I remember going back to the days, you know, like I said, when we would see bands like Suicidal Tendencies and Rocky George, him and Hendrix are tied at the top one for my favorite guitarists ever. I mean, Hendrix is the godfather, but I mean, Rocky George is fucking insane if you've ever heard him play. You familiar with him?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, some of the stuff Rocky did, I mean, especially when they brought him in on, that was, I believe it was the third or fourth album, How Will I Laugh Tomorrow, when I Can't Even Smile, that they released in 88, where he was kind of helping them transition from more punk to thrash, and then Life, Camera, Revolution in 1990, they were just balls out thrash. And I mean, God, I mean, that dude has some of those solos that he had, he left the fucking earth on. And I'm like, this is a black man, you know, from Culver City, California. You know, you look at Ice-T with what he did with Body Count. You know, I mean, this is a time, these were people of color doing it at a time. I mean, you look at Public Enemy and Anthrax to Bring the Noise. You know, I mean, so this is in the 90s where this was not necessarily a popular thing to do. It was revolutionary.
Right.
But that laid down the foundation of what you would eventually do with it. So in terms of you playing, because I was an aspiring guitar player when I was young, still like to just pick it up now and again, but you know, so when you started playing, what guitars did you find really worked for you in terms of how you ended up finding, you know, the guitar that was really your fit?
You said, how did I find the guitar that was my fit?
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's a good question. When I first started playing guitar, my mom got me this really shitty guitar. It was like a starter guitar pack from like Costco or Sam's or something like that. So it's not like I was getting, you know, a guitar with the best wood and the best, you know, treatment and processing and all that kind of stuff. But I'm thankful for that, because that's what opened up my ears to understanding the art of tone. So I used to take the guitars apart and try to put them back together to understand the structure of a guitar and why it is the way it is and how it makes the sounds that it does, beyond memorizing what some white guy on YouTube told me to play, you know, Lentine Spirit. I wanted to understand why the instrument was so integral in this style of music. Because why couldn't, instead of guitar, why not a piano, or why not an oboe? Why not a clarinet? Guitar is a staple in rock and roll sound. So I wanted to understand why and what that means. So I think over time, as I just used to learn a lot on my own by learning how to play and watching videos, trying to take them apart, put them back together, trying different strings. I used to go to Guitar Center a lot and after school and just play on different guitars to listen to the different sounds. I would play the same thing on like 10 different guitars, and I was listening for the differences. So I think over time I started just buying different guitars and experimenting with that plus my pedal board, and just kept tweaking stuff until I figured out what I wanted. But I never threw stuff away, because I figured it might not be what I want right now, but I might evolve into that later.
So fast forwarding to now, I have like all of my guitars that I bought since I started playing, except for the one that I took apart. That's because I use it as like a supplies guitar. So if I need like quick, random, easy parts, then I just like pop them off of that. But fast forwarding to now, I have 14 guitars and 2 basses and like 3 different pedal boards and, you know, 5 amps and all of this stuff that kind of gives me a different side of the tone that I feel like expressing. I think a lot of guitarists or a lot of musicians can sometimes evolve in their tone over time, whether that's for voice or for instrument. But I feel like sometimes you can become stagnant because you leave the other versions of your tone, the other iterations of your tone behind. To me, all of those iterations of my tone, whether they were shitty or whether they were really, really good, those things were elements and instrumental in the tone that I have now. So I keep all of those things over the years and experiment with, you know what, for this song, I want it to sound grunge, but I want it to sound like my first era of when I first started writing grunge music. So I might pick up a guitar that I know is going to give me a nice round fat bottom, like a TRS, for example. It's going to give me a nice, creamy, classy.
But give me
a nice rounded out bass, not bass heavy, but, you know, a nice even tone. And then I might add my EMG pickups, because I know they're going to be hot. They're going to give me a bite. And then I might take my analog, like one of my analog pedals, and then dial in between that. And then go out of one of my favorite tube amps to kind of give me that natural reverb, and I'll have the sound from the first iteration of Guitar's album. So I think tone is definitely something that has played a huge role in my evolution as an artist.
When you look at guitars, I mean, it's definitely about, like you said, about tone. When you look at Nuno Betancourt playing a Washburn, you know, he has that kind of quacky, quirky sound, like what he did on, I mean, especially their second album, Porno Graffiti, and Resize Every Story, which is stellar. And, of course, I mean, when you look at Rocky George playing Ibanez, he was a guy.
Yeah.
I swear, between him and Dave Mustaine from Megadeth, because I love Jackson's because of the diversity and the sound. But God damn it, when I saw Rocky in that You Can't Bring Me Down video with that white Ibanez, I was hooked.
Oh, yeah, that white Ibanez was good. You know, my first, I call it my first real guitar, but after I had that, like, crappy Johnson, I think it was a Johnson, but after I had that first crappy guitar, my first real guitar was an Ibanez OG-120, and I actually just
the
picked it up from my tech.
Yes,
I picked it up from my tech last week. Because I haven't played it in, like, 6 years, and I was like, you know what? And this is why... Going back to the question you just asked me, I was like, you know what? Because I'm working on my album and about to start recording. So I said, let me go back to my old tone. So I pulled out my Ibanez, the RG120. It's a faithful guitar.
I mean, are you familiar with the RB, Red Beach, with the Coa Wood and all that? Are you familiar with?
Yeah, I just don't have one of those. But yeah, I am. Ibanez is one of my favorite guitars.
But
I love
Rocky, I mean, but especially listening to the Jacksons. I mean, when you would hear Marty Friedman, especially when he had that Kelly. Matter of fact, when I saw Morbid Angel play live, Trey Azatope had that Jackson Warrior. I mean,
right? Yeah.
But I mean, just to watch the videos, and I mean, of course, Slash with the signature Gibson, Les Paul. I mean, oh my God! I mean, that's just a link forever with him, and that solo went forever in November Rain. I mean,
yeah, oh God!
So in terms of some of the music you've written, who were some? And I this is kind of a offbeat question. What were some of the solos that you heard that would inspire some of the songs that you wrote?
You know what? There's a song by Steve Vai. It's called Die to Live. Die to Live is one of my favorite songs. Steve Vai is one of my favorite guitarists, but I'm not going to go on a tangent about Steve Vai. But Die to Live is one of my favorite songs. Yeah, no, Steve is a genius. I absolutely love Steve Vai. Talk about, like, crazy sounds. And honestly, Steve Vai, when I started listening to Steve Vai, like, old Steve Vai, that's really what pushed me to say, you know what? Let me try to, like, get different pedals that I've never, like, tried before. So I started venturing into other pedals beyond, like, a regular distortion or a grunge pedal, because I just wanted to see, like, how is he making all these sounds with, like, pedals and his hands on his guitar? Like, what is that even? Anywho, but Steve Vai, Die to Live, for sure. And then, what was the song? No, it's called, but I love Joe Satriani. Always With Me, Always With You. Definitely my fave.
Oh,
I have a song
that I wrote as well, her song.
Yeah, I heard, yeah. And I love stuff like that. And that's what I mean by black artists using different eras of our music and, like, mixing it together. Like, most fans that are Nicki Minaj fans are not going to know that that's Joe Satriani.
Right, yeah, right.
But they're also
me.
Not
going to
know
right
the history of rock. Right.
Yeah, she used that. Yeah, right through me. Because I recognized that when I first heard it. She used, I'm like, wait a minute. Is that Always With Me, Always With You, also Surfing With the Alien by Joe Satriani?
Right. And By the Sword. That's the song that I was thinking about. It's By the Sword by Slash. That was off of, like, Slash's solo project. Yeah.
Slash.
I love that song.
Man, I mean, but of course, Steve Vai, for a lot of people who really know, he was, of course, in Crossroads, you know, with Ralph Macchio. He was on guitar, which a lot of people don't know, that he was playing both of those guitar parts.
Yeah.
And, of course, who can forget him when he was with David Lee Roth, when David Lee Roth started his band.
Yeah.
You know, him, Greg Bissonette, and Billy Sheehan as well. I mean, Steve is a passionate warfare. I mean, the concert he did with Eric Johnson and Joe Satriani.
Yeah.
I mean, Steve is a... And, of course, that gym guitar, the Ibanez. It is like the Air Jordans of guitar.
Right.
Man. So how did it... So you're currently endorsed by PRS Guitars, yes?
Mm-hmm.
So how was that? So how did that endorsement come about in terms of the process? How did you get on their radar to where they offered you that?
Well, I mean, honestly, they didn't offer me anything. I had to go get what I knew that I wanted to elevate me to the next level. Prior to that, my first company that I was ever endorsed with was Ernie Ball. And that was because of an amazing friend, Kingfish, Chris Stone Ingram. Very proud of him and everything that he's done at such a young age. And Chris, I think, just released an album, so shout out to Chris. But I got with Ernie Ball, and then after that I got with ESP Guitars. And I left and that's the bright green guitar that people probably see me playing most of the time for a very long time at the beginning of my career with Tulip. But I ended up leaving ESP and kind of just breaking off because I didn't feel valued as a black person, a black musician, a black female on their roster. There was only one person that really saw and understood me and what the mission of Tulips was and wanted to be a stepping stone and helping me with that. And that guy was Jeff Moore. I always shout out Jeff because, again, Jeff is one of those people where I believe that when you get in spaces, you've got to find the right person. You don't need 3,000 people. You don't need 15,000 fans. You don't need to know everybody in the company. You just need one. And my one at ESP was Jeff Moore. So leaving ESP and kind of having the experience that I had prompted me to say, you know what, my next endorsement company, I want to be with a company that makes products that's going to express a different side of my tone that I've always been drawn to and played, but I've never been able to really dig into. Years before I got with TRS, I'm talking like 10 years before I got with TRS, this older couple on Facebook blessed me with a free TRS SE Afro. And they found it online. The husband was a bass player, and they found it online. And the person who was selling it, I don't think they knew what they were saying, but it was a brand new untouched TRS SE acetate. And it was, I think, like $400 or $500. I was a college student, I didn't have no money, but they ended up blessing me with that guitar, and I didn't realize at that moment that 10 years later, I would be endorsed with that same company. So PRS has been an integral part of what I was saying earlier in terms of just experimenting with different levels of my tone over the years, the evolution of it, and then you know, building my brand along with that, going back to the green and cross industries and music and conservation. I reached out to PRS and said, you know, hey, this is who I am. You might know me, you might not know me, but if you don't, I would like to fix that and develop a relationship, not just because of the instruments, but again, like developing a relationship. Anybody can get stuff sent to them. but I want to be with a company that is going to develop a relationship and help cross barriers and create spaces for people of color and marginalized identities that have not been otherwise given that. PRS still has a way to go and still has some work to do, but PRS has also been one of the few companies that I have worked with, been affiliated with, been endorsed with in any capacity that has been very supportive. PRS has been a huge supporter of giving lots of great gear for the Tulip Stand to play at different shows. And so I'm thankful to PRS and developing that relationship with them over the years. But again, it started with a horrible experience that I wanted to not let that be, you know, what endorsement meant to me and my brain. So, yeah.
I feel you. We think about what happened. I like to talk about endorsements with ESP, because I knew about ESP for watching Chris DeGarmo and Michael Wilson from Queensryche play. You know, and of course, PRS, I got familiar watching Ted Nugent when he was with Damn Yankees play, because I always recognized that Zebra Stripe guitar. But like you said, Gabby, endorsements are everything, and it's always about feeling like you're respected. I know everybody may know the story about, this is kind of how parallels with the sports world. Years ago, with Nike, when Steph Curry was there, this story too, when they goofed up and they had all name when he was in the meeting with them, and that's how, you know, he ended up going to Under Armour, you know, because they, you know, Nike, and I'm a strictly Nike head, but I'm like, when you make mistakes, you make mistakes, but they goofed up the presentation, and that's how Steph ended up going to Under Armour. But it is about the situation where you feel like, even with the situation with Kyrie Irving and how he left Nike, you know, well, really the situation was a contract was about to expire for both parties, mutually decided to go their separate ways. But when Kyrie got with Anta, you know, because it was a chapter for his life where he felt like he had the creative expression and input. Art is very intimate in terms of music. Art is anything that you express yourself in. It's like with Off the Cuff, what we do. So we all understand collectively what it means that you want to have a situation that allows you to be your authentic self and to really bring that to the world. So you don't want to feel like you're not being appreciated or you're not recognized. And I think that's the most important thing in any capacity, no matter what profession you are in. So when you look at it in terms of all the gifts you've had, you know, that you've developed, the talent you've honed. Tell us about when you started doing your web series, your webinar series, you know, giving the aspiring artists and just teaching them about what goes on in the business at large.
Yeah, going back to what we started with in this conversation, I think exposure to other possibilities and career paths and information is important. I started getting involved on like board of director type stuff from a young age, interning with a lot of conservation nonprofits. I was exposed to being in spaces where there were the real, I call them the real conversations, but the real conversations at the real table that were being had. And, you know, by the time those things get sifted through, you know, different people, and, you know, they're branded strategist, and then their editor, and then they put it, you know, in this nicely packaged thing, then it becomes four sentences that we call a mission statement that gets put up on a website with black faces or people of color or marginalized identities that are holding up this branded mission statement, but the conversations in the boardroom don't align with that. So when I started getting involved in entertainment board of director spaces, I really started being exposed to, like, wow, so this is the stuff that's actually happening behind the scenes. I wonder if musicians know that there are other ways to do this, or that this is how the law actually works. Like, it is possible to be independent. Prince did it. A lot of other amazing artists did it as well, but they had to start from somewhere. It's not like they were birthed, you know, inside of the boardroom with access to all this knowledge. So for me, access to knowledge and access to information is key. And I think a lot of times what happens in the music industry, and unfortunately in the black community, when we get to certain levels where we feel like we've made it, or we get certain levels of leadership and power, then we begin to gatekeep.
because we don't want anybody else on that same space. We want, you know, that space or that level for us. I'm not like that. You know, I've had to experience a lot of that from people who were like that, and it put me in a position where I didn't have a choice but to figure it out. So if I wanted to learn something, I had to go find it. I had to go find it. And that's why I'm such a good researcher now. Because if I need something, I know that it's on the internet. So it's not a question of, is this a possibility or is this something that is out there? It is out there and it is a possibility. It's just that's not what is marketed to our communities, and that theme being knowledge. So for me, being in positions where I learn a lot and have been exposed to a lot and have had the privilege of perspective and listening to things and really examining, you know, how this industry is run, I believe in, you know, turning around and giving access to that knowledge back to people that are like me and that are the reasons why these genres continue to exist.
Absolutely. And when you talk about knowledge is something that should not be hoarded. Knowledge should be something that is shared along, you know, with everybody, because there cannot be a situation where one person, because so many people think that when, you know, you, basically helping one person win does not mean you're going to lose. When one person wins, we all win, because it's a collective motion of what we are all trying to accomplish from a shared goal and vision. So it doesn't, if anything, the advancement is how the bridges are built, is how there is a pragmatic solution that is achieved. But too many times we see people that are not trying to, you know, it's just like, well, especially from those who feel like, well, I had to find my way through, you know, you got to find your way through. I'm like, no, my thing is, my job is, if I got to a certain place, the level of success is that it's my job to help those who come behind me, that they are able to have an easier trail. You know, because we got so much where in the industry, you know, people don't want to help each other. And it's a crab in the bucket mentality. Don't nobody want to see nobody get out of it.
Right.
You know, and we can't have that, especially for, you know, what we're trying to do as a people. When you look at how music is now in terms of how songs are written, Gabby, do you see any difference from what it was back in the day of our youth growing up, in terms of how there was the musicianship, how it's marketed? Tell us what you've observed from it.
Yeah, it just, you know, I got to run after like this question because I got to walk my dog who is singing on the in another room. But I think that it's funny because earlier today my dad sent my our family a group message with a video of Jermaine Dupri saying that he was against AI being used in the music industry. And when I listened to what he said, I completely agreed, because I was in a Recording Academy board meeting last week or the week before, and we were talking about how AI impacts the music industry, but specifically what does that look like for the Grammys and for people that are, you know, submitting music and artistry to win awards and accolades and accomplishments. And there's a lot of big problems that are ahead of us if we don't have these conversations now, like the question that you're asking. So my response to that is,
right,
you know, in part what Jermaine Dupri was saying, which is when you start using technology to replace humans and replace people's voices and the time and the experiences and the emotions that someone took to develop their voice, to be able to reach somebody else through a song, when you remove that from music, in my opinion, you don't have music. You have a ton of stuff that is computerized and sounds great and will probably sell, you know, because everybody is, you know, on social media 24/7, so it's not like it's hard to sell a song if you have the money to back the branding for it.
Right.
But it doesn't have sustainability and traction. And I think that removes from the future of music, and I think that it removes a very important aspect that young kids now are not going to learn if we don't teach them. And that's still being, like you said, the principles of musicianship. What does it mean to play the guitar? It's not just memorizing how to play something. A computer can do that. So if you can't, like, dig deeper than that,
then in my opinion, what exactly is you missing? You know, are you looking to put something together real quick to make a couple, you know, coins on Instagram or TikTok viral videos? But so that's my thing. I think a lot of the music now is beginning to miss the elements of sustainable musicianship.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, you know what? And one thing about it, too, is that I feel like it's we made, you know, everybody looks at technology as being this convenience, but by the same token, it's like, you know, we look at it from this perspective, and it's like, look, I mean, everybody wants to download music. Don't nobody want to really buy anything anymore, or they don't, I mean, how do you see in terms of marketing, in terms of physical copies, in terms of all of that, how it's been changing?
Well, I think we can thank the pandemic for that because, you know, going on tour is not an anomaly, but touring now versus before the pandemic, or really think about touring now versus when Tina Turner was touring. You know, people back in the day, like you, if you wanted to hear your favorite artist's music, you had no choice but to go and purchase it. And if you wanted to hear it over and over again, you had to get up, pick up the records from your record shelf, dust it off, put it on the thing, and make sure that the needle was right where it needs to be to start at the beginning of your favorite song or to start at the halfway point. Now, because we have phones and everything everywhere, you know, you don't even have to get out the bed. You know, and that's what a lot of people do, you know, you wake up in the morning, the first thing a lot of people in America do is get on TikTok and look at what is the next viral dance move or the next sensation. And I'm not saying that those things don't have a role in marketing and a role in touring and selling merch and all these things, but I think when that becomes the sole thing that we're using to develop or to evolve the industry, that concerns me because, again, it removes a lot of principles that the rich business people at the top of this pyramid, you know, they use elements of hard work and, you know, learning business and learning how to market and learning how to read statistics and analytics to strategize to make money. But, you know, at this level and on other levels of this totem pole, if you will, people don't have to do that anymore because you can just get on TikTok. You don't even have to go into a studio now. You don't even have to buy a laptop. You can download an app and make a song, say AI or have AI make you something, and you got a new song, and now you're a TikTok sensation. But I think that, again, it removes elements of business principle that, you know, you can't just wake up and have everything you want. You have to work for it. And if you do wake up and have everything you want, then how long does that really last? Where's the sustainability in that? Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great breakdown, though. I mean, a lot of times people don't understand expediency, you know, and convenience is not always going to equate to great. You know, sometimes art is something that needs to be appreciated and takes time to really get into, you know. And I don't think it's something that's just disposable where you just kind of take it at a leisure like that. You know, I look at how magazines are and everything. And, you know, we don't even really have magazines out there anymore. But that's also something that you are into as well. So tell us about you being your writing prowess doing this.
Okay, but after this, I got to run because I got to go get my dogs. But I was actually just looking at our last magazine edition. But outside of the music things, Tulips does a lot of curation for different media entities, one of those being Guitar Girl magazine. And we curate this special edition called I Belong, and it is an edition that is solely dedicated to highlighting female and gender expansive artists of color. And to me, that's really important because, you know, everybody has different experiences, no matter what demographic you come from, how you identify. We all have experiences that at its core are things that we all can relate to. And I think to not have those voices being given a platform to share their stories and be inspiration for their communities, then, you know, we're missing a huge part of what it means to have a diverse music community. So that magazine we curate every year to highlight really for us, by us, type of vibe. So we just released our third edition of that a few months ago, and it's a really special thing to be able to do that. And right now I also write for Guitar World magazine, and I'm working on a series that kind of talks about conservation meeting instrument manufacturing in the industry and how voices of color are missing from that equation and from that piece. So I'll kind of summarize everything I've said today with one of my favorite quotes that I heard somewhere, but they said, I think it was on Women in Hip Hop documentary on Netflix, but one of the artists on there said, if you don't have, without black women's voices, you don't have rock and roll. You don't have music without our voices. You can appropriate all you want. You can brand it and make it look good, but without our voices and our representation, you know, music is not, the movement of music is not sustainable. So, yeah.
Gabby, this has been incredible. This has been so enlightening, invigorating, educational, instructional. Like you said, we know you got to go. We got to do a part two of this. We thank you so much for your patience. Yeah, man, I mean, it took a long time, but we finally got it done. And once again, thank you for that stuff you sent me in the mail, man, baby. I truly appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. Thank y'all for having me.
Always.
Absolutely. You're welcome back anytime. Before you go, before you hop off, baby, tell everybody where they can find you.
Sorry, somebody was saying something.
Yeah, tell everybody where they can find you online.
Okay, you can follow me online at Guitar Gabby. If you just Google Guitar Gabby, everything will pop up, all social media and music and websites.
Look, it's something special, man. Look out, you know, for the great guitar girl in the tulips, Guitar Gabby in the tulips. Y'all look out. Support, listen, stream, buy the albums, everything, man. This girl has got a treasure of talent and knowledge that she is sharing with all of us in the world. Thank you again so much. And give everybody your best. Thank you again. Appreciate you.
Likewise. Thanks, y'all. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Right,
you too. King, take us out of here, brother.
On that note, we up out of here. Thank you, Guitar Gabby, for joining us, and we will be back next week.
Peace and God bless. Thank you all for listening again, and we out.